This programme was previously broadcast live on Love Sport Radio, so some items may be out of date. For more podcasts or to listen live, visit lovesportradio.com.
Good evening, you are listening to Love Sport Radio and this is the Manchester United Fan Show. Me, Matt Beadle, with you through to 11pm and joined, as always, by Mr. Ben Senior. Hello, Ben.
Evening, mate. How are we?
Very well, thank you. Very well. It's been an interesting weekend of international activity. Before we get to that, by the way, I just want to quickly touch on the United women's team. They went down 1-0 at Chelsea today, a narrow defeat at King's Meadow. Interesting, because of course they got promoted as championship winners last season and battling high in the WSL. It has to be said, the top tier, 9 points from 6 games. When you consider they're in fifth spot against some of those more established sides, it is always that odd goal that they seem to lose out on. 1-0 at Chelsea to be today. Lost against City and Arsenal, I believe, as well, by the same margin.
Yeah, it's good to see, isn't it? And I think, like you said, that Chelsea are quite a big team in the women's game and they have been for a few years. So long may it continue that United's women keep going up and up.
Yep, on the up, a massive transition, of course, with that return. I think it was since 2004 when they disbanded, 15 years on, and they are slowly getting back to where they once were. Elsewhere in the men's game, Marcus Rashford back on the score sheet for England today.
Yeah, he's been on fire recently, hasn't he? He played very well again today. Done really well in recent times for United and England, and looks back to being full of confidence and that player that we all expect him and want him to be.
I mean, in terms of the England form, today, of course, Harry Maguire in as well. He had a good game. But the fact that that Rashford scoring for club and country can only be a good thing.
Yeah. In that England team, he looks like one of the first names on Gareth Southgate's team sheet, really, when it comes to that forward lineup. I think he's ahead of Jadon Sancho in the pecking order for England. And yeah, like I said, he just seems to have that edge back. He's got it. You can see it in his eyes. He's got it back. He's got the eye for goal. He's scoring some really good goals as well. It's not just tap-ins he's scoring. He's scoring and absolutely finishing them right off. So yeah, it's good to see his pace is back. He's beating men and he's hitting it top bins. So
9 in his last 10, I think that is as well. And that is, I mean, listen, if people have criticised his scoring pedigree before, that is a guy very much on fine form, in momentum. I'm quite excited about it. I have to say, another player I'm also quite excited about is Daniel James. Another good performance for Wales. Cut in, did his classic trademark cut in, rocket of a shot, came off the bar. Harry Wilson nodded it in. They beat Azerbaijan 2-0, but again, performing at the highest level.
Yeah, I mean, Dan James must be thinking, what's happened these past sort of 6 to 8 months? He's gone from being a championship player with Swansea, very nearly signing for Leeds, as we all know, and then suddenly he's a vital player for United and a vital player for Wales. I don't think either United or the Welsh national team could do without him at the minute.
No, definitely not. Well, he was a new signing in the summer, of course. We're going to get onto your potential transfer targets in the next section. You've drawn up a list of players that you're hoping United plump for in January. Some of those players are from Serie A. Apparently that's a ding. Is something happening on the show?
I think that's Ed Woodward there.
Yeah, he doesn't want us to talk about it. He does not want us to talk about it. Sorry, Ed, but we are going to talk about it. We spoke to Rich Hall, senior football correspondent at Football Italia, earlier. Obviously, Man United in for Mario Mandzukic, we're led to believe he's already prepared to train for the club. Another name is Emre Can. I know we've spoken about him, Ben, yet not happy about that one at all, especially because of his previous history. When I think about players, and I mentioned this to Rich, what we're talking, Michael Owen, obviously used to play for Liverpool, ended up at Manchester United inadvertently with a couple of clubs in between, Paul Ince being the other, of course, going to Inter Milan in Serie A. Some links with Inter as well, of course, Romelu Lukaku and Alexis Sanchez over there. It remains to be seen whether Sanchez returns. But we spoke to Rich about those initial two targets, Mario Mandzukic and Emre Can, and whether there was anything in them.
I think with Mario Mandzukic, it certainly looks like a possibility. He's a player that Juventus have, in the past, really utilised very well. I think, especially now that it's Sardi's in charge, he feels that possibly he doesn't suit his style of football. I mean, just in context to this, Juventus are in a huge transition. And when I say huge, monumental. The football they played under Allegri was rigid, but it was also, it was gritty in a sense. It was clinical. And you know, Juventus' motto is that winning isn't all that counts, it's the only thing. And so Mandzukic fit that type of football that Allegri played. He was utilised, believe it or not, even though he's not the quickest player out on the left, and as a target man as well at various points. Since Sarri's coming, he wants to move the ball quicker. He wants to really speed up the play. So Mandzukic has sort of been, not ostracised by any shades of the imagination, but you know he's not had as much of a role. Even people like Dybala have struggled to get a lot of football. He's changed the team around a lot. So with the window coming up, I mean, with the age of Mandzukic as well, I think he'd be a fantastic fit for a lot of clubs because he's still got an awful amount of ability. And this is a real possibility in my eyes. He's one of the people that I always look at compare what the English media are doing and the Italian media. You tend to, especially in the January window, there tends to be more fire and smoke to it when both medias are talking about it. There's a lot in the summer from both sides and it felt like it nearly happened. This is one I could really see going again in January.
But Mandzukic, I mean, you say he's not been ostracised, but I mean, there have been reports that he's not even training with Juve at the moment. I don't believe he's played a single minute this season. Is that right? So if he was to come to United, are United getting, and again, there are rumours that he's apparently already reached an agreement and that he'll start training with United as early as December. But if he does join United, like you say, we're getting a 33-year-old. Yes, a vastly experienced 33-year-old, but one who hasn't played football since the back end of last season.
Yeah, it's a strange one because with Maurizio Sarri, he always... How can I explain it? Whilst he's not been playing minutes on the pitch, there are a lot of rumours in Italy, but from what it's been noticed mostly is that there's quite a few players at Juventus who, whilst it looked like they weren't going to play too much, they started to just coming into this sort of period. You know, you look at the likes of everyone thought originally in the pre-season that Sami Khedira, for instance, wasn't going to play at all. Mm. Next thing, he becomes almost integral. So Sarri has like he did at Napoli, he took 16 players, wanted to just utilise them inside out. And the ones on the sideline, there was nothing against them. It just didn't fit his style. So your question still holds, though, in the sense of, you know, this guy, I still believe from reports that he has been training, but even so, you know, it's game time. So it will take a little bit to bed in. The interesting thing is, it depends how United what they need him for. If they're going to look to him to lead the line in every game, or do what he did under Allegri and play constantly out on the left wing, especially, you know, when you look at the type of football that United are wanting to play, or the fans especially want them to play, it doesn't fit. If you're looking at the fans, that Mandzukic is a player who you can bring into the squad, who's vastly experienced, as you say, who can certainly score goals, extremely intelligent, a very tactical player, who can come on later on in the games and be used off the bench, then it makes perfect sense. So it just depends on how Solskjaer wants to use him.
And Emre Can, the other Juve player, of course, has only made 4 appearances, that's including subs, in Serie A so far this season. He looks like someone who's out in the cold at Juve. Now, this would be rather controversial from a Man United perspective, of course, a former Liverpool player. If I think of recent examples, well, Michael Owen, I suppose, is the most recent. Before that, Paul Ince, probably obviously going to Inter and then back to Liverpool. Emre Can, is that a possibility?
It's a possibility because, like Mandzukic, it looks like Sadi's, you know, could do without him. Especially the reason that as well, which I should have said before, that both of these transfers are possible is because you don't often get a coach saying, my squad's too big. Maurizio Sarri has certainly been doing that at the beginning of the season. And, you know, even the likes of Antonio Conte at Inter have picked up on this. And there's a bit of a war of words going on between them, with Conte saying, you know, listen, I have 3 players injured and I've got no squad, whilst others have got, they don't even need all their players. So, you know, that's why Maurizio Sarri, you can see, there's certain players who he'll happily get rid of. And it looks like he's got the backing of the board at this moment as well, if that's what's needed. Now, Emre Can is a player. I would say that I don't want to speak on behalf of Juventus fans, but I would say that many of them would have said he hasn't performed well, even under Allegri, and for a long time. You know, for Juventus, yes, he's had his moments. Yes, he's been useful in certain games, and especially when they've been going deep in all competitions. I don't see what value he would have to go to United, what he would bring to that United midfield. He's professional, of course. I think that's probably the one thing I could say. But I think as well, when you've got a club that, like United, Manchester United, that feels so passionately about their rivalry with Liverpool and his history, you need a player to be on the top of their game that's really going to bring something and turn the fans around. Yes, he could come and do a job, but I think that he could easily have the fans turn in quite quickly.
Moving on to Inter Milan and this quite bizarre merry-go-round of players that seems to be occurring between United and Inter. Of course, Romelu Lukaku and Alexis Sanchez going to Inter in the summer, one for a permanent, one for a loan deal that may well prove to be permanent at the end of next season. Nemanja Matic is a player who started just two Premier League games for United. He's sidelined with an injury, a bit of a hoodoo injury. No one really knows what's going on there, but he's been linked with a move to Inter in January. Of course, his contract is up at the end of the season, so United might choose to cash in. And potentially coming the other way, but not in January, at the end of the season, is Lautaro Martinez. Of course, now he's bagged 8 goals and 3 assists in 16 games for Inter this season. A front man that United potentially need alongside Marcus Rashford and Anthony Martial. Can you see any movement with Matic and Martinez?
Clear the Martinez one first. I don't really see that happening at all for two reasons. One, Inter have, obviously they've got Romelu Lukaku, as you say now, who has recaptured some form. But Martinez is the real protege that they've been looking for a while, especially when Mauro Icardi and that whole incident happened with him when they lost one. No matter what baggage Icardi had, he was a goal scorer and a good goal scorer. Very difficult to replace. Martinez has been extremely professional. Conte loves him in that sense. They're trying to renegotiate a new deal that will see him with a much bigger release, with big release clause put in there that will ward away quite a lot of clubs. And he's also very happy at the club. He speaks very openly about it. He's still very young. Absolutely brilliant talent. And Inter really don't want to lose him. They can't afford to lose him when in the summer they'll also be losing Icardi permanently to PSG. The likes of Perisic will be going. Inter also, it has to be said, they're under the Sun Inn group now, which have got very deep pockets, and we're talking almost as deep as the likes of Paris Saint-Germain, but they've not been able to do it because of financial fair play, not really been able to spend the money. So Martinez, I've seen it very, very difficult for not just Manchester United, but many teams to move for him, because he's also been linked with Barcelona. The Matic move, I would say that's probably the most likely one we'll probably talk about. Conte's made it very, very clear. He wants him. Simple as that. He's been very open about the players he wants, to the point where it's become an annoyance for Inter. In the summer, he wanted Edin Dzeko. He banged on about that as much as he possibly could. And when he didn't get him, he made it publicly known he was disappointed. He feels, as I said before, his squad is not got enough depth. Of course, next year, they're wanting the likes of Milinkovic-Savic and Federico Chiesa. But right now, they're not going to get them in January. So the two players that Conte has come out and said he wants, Olivier Giroud or another striker of that type, and Nemanja Matic seems the most obvious because he knows him and he knows he can get him hopefully fairly cheaply from his point of view, just to see up that midfield. Whether that be a fit, who knows? But Conte wants some experienced players around him because he did say, especially after a recent defeat, that he's got a lot of promising young players coming through, a lot of older players, but he needs experienced players and winners, and so that's why he's looking for Matic.
Yeah, there's so much linkage here, isn't there, Rich? You mentioned Milinkovic-Savic there. He's a player who's been linked with United for as long as I can remember, as has Kalidou Koulibaly, of course. Now, we're led to believe that an approach was rejected by Napoli in the summer, but they're not the force that they have been in Serie A. There are various issues going on at the moment, languishing in seventh. The stingy defence that we know isn't particularly showing up. Just 5 clean sheets, actually, in all comps in the games that Koulibaly has played. We're led to believe, again, allegedly, that he's receiving threats from the club's ultras. That is alleged. We don't know for sure whether that's happening. But Il Mattino, of course, that's a daily newspaper in Naples, are suggesting that Napoli might be willing to part company with Koulibaly in January for a considerably less fee than they were asking for in the summer.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you'd have asked me this in the summer, I would have said there's absolutely zero chance that the chairman De Laurentiis would part ways with Koulibaly. Just because whilst they're not one of the richest clubs in Europe, they don't have to sell. Also, their fans are so passionate, they can easily turn, and that would have been a move that would have made that happen. Since then, though, this season, and even Carlo Ancelotti's relationship with De Laurentiis has plummeted. Napoli have been unlucky. They're playing really good football. They're just not being clinical enough. That front three of Mertens, Insigne and Callejon has just not been able to find the net enough. Now there's Milik. And so, defensively, they've also struggled a little bit. Now, the interesting thing about this is that it got to a point where they looked like they were on the precipice, really, of which way they were going to go. And the results didn't go their way. And in Italy, which we don't see over in England, they have a ritiro, which means basically it's a retreat. And what happens is the players lose the game on the Saturday, and the coach or the president says, OK, we're going to a training camp for the full week till the next game. You don't see your families, you don't see your children. You're just in this environment. And normally it gets a 1-2 game reaction. It's not very successful, in fairness. This happened recently with De Laurentiis saying to Ancelotti and his players, listen, you're going into this retreat. Ancelotti thought that the team had been playing well and said, actually, no, we're not going to do this. Well, they don't know if it's a player's revolt or a coach's revolt. Anyway, 2 days later, they all went home. So there's a lot going on at Napoli at the moment. Ancelotti's future is in danger. De Laurentiis is also now apparently looking to sell the club. The ultras, of course, as in most Italian clubs, are very, very putting a lot of pressure on the whole team. And also, we've got to remember Koulibaly's experienced an awful amount of racism, racist abuse, in not just in Naples, but especially in the games against Inter. So this is probably the moment for any team to be able to look to go and get Koulibaly. The fee, I still think, would be quite a lot. But it would seem that this is probably the worst place Napoli have been in a while. So that would be interesting. I mean, I struggle to still think if it would be a January move. But certainly at the end of the season, if Napoli don't improve, I could see him going.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. Rich, just before you go, I want to touch on one more player, and that is a player many United fans are very excited about and have been very excited about since he joined the club as a youth teamer. Still just 19, Tahith Chong. Now, a lot of United fans are also slightly concerned about recent reports suggesting that he's yet to sign a new deal and that apparently Juve are readying a bid for him. Now, we saw a very similar scenario back in 2012 with Paul Pogba. And there is a concern here that if he holds off signing that contract, Juve will swoop and he will go to Serie A.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Now, this has been quite quiet on the Italian front, but it's mainly been in UK papers. But the interesting thing about this is that when Juventus go after a main player, you know, whether that's especially when they're sort of pillaging Roma or one of the other clubs in Serie A, they make a whole song and dance about it. They really go to town on the fact that they're going to target Benedeschi, for instance, when they did that against Fiorentina. You know, that they're going to come in and they're going to get their player. It unsettles the player. It really forces the club to think, actually, you know, we can get a good amount of money from Juventus. And that's the way they used to conduct their business in some respect. This is different. And I think with the youth team players, especially now that Nedved and Patrici have really got control of the way that club's operating, they do go to ground a bit on some of the younger players because they know that the clubs can rush them into a contract that sometimes are more easily influenced at that age, especially when they're trying to secure their futures, especially when they're at a club like Manchester United. If you get offered a big contract, you sign. So that will be an interesting one to watch. But all I can say from an Italian perspective, very, very quiet in the papers on this one. So maybe that's some hope for United.
Brilliant. Rich, excellent stuff as always.
No problems anytime, guys.
For the fans, by the fans. Love Sport Radio.
The Manchester United fan show here on Love Sport, as we've just seen footage of Cristiano Ronaldo's 99th goal for Portugal. And when you talk about the crackers he's scored over the years, Ben, that was not one.
No, poked it in on the goal line, didn't he?
I mean, that was Diogo Jota's goal, but it's classic, isn't it? When Ronaldo gets tap-ins like that and nicks a goal off someone, no one cares.
No.
They're like, go on, we love you. Score.
It's in the record books now, isn't it?
It is. So close to that 100th. Surely only a matter of time for him. By the way, also interestingly, Ronaldo is sort of reverting back to that first ever haircut he had when he signed for United, with those little tassels over the front.
Little blonde highlights.
Yeah. Although he's remained with the dark hair. No more Sir Alex to tell him to chop them off. Sorry. Right, before the ads, we spoke to Rich Hall, senior football correspondent at Football Italia. Really good chat, that, with some real inside knowledge on Serie A and, in particular, the transfer targets for United. The one that stood out the most for me was Napoli's Koulibaly. First of all, the ritiro, as he said, which is the crazy system they have in Serie A, whereby the team isn't performing, they take them off to a retreat for a week. No family interaction, nothing. You've got to go to this retreat and stay there and come back. And like he said, it tends to only have a reaction of one or two games. But quite crucially in this instance, Napoli went against it. They went for like 2 days and were like, no, Carlo Ancelotti wasn't having any of it. Koulibaly it seems, is having a tough time at Napoli, a team that he's always stuck by, getting some stick from his fans, of course suffering in Serie A with the racism, ongoing racism that seems to be happening week after week now that we keep seeing. Of course, Mario Balotelli as well, having his issues out there. Moise Keane, of course, he had issues and has since come to the Premier League, although may not be staying because he's having his own problems. Everton, not racism problems, but just problems with seemingly turning up for training on time. But Koulibaly, Rich said, now is as good a time as any. I mean, we've been linked with him for so long, but it's as good a time as any. Apparently, United were up for signing him in the summer, went for Harry Maguire instead for 80 million. They wanted upwards of 80 million for Koulibaly, but potentially in January, they're saying it might come down, still expensive, but to around the 70 million mark.
Yeah, it's interesting what Rich was saying there. Koulibaly, I think he is a top draw centre-half. When you look at world football, I think he's up there with the top five, top ten defenders in the world. And in the summer, when we were sort of scouting around the transfer market and seeing who we could sign for United in that position, I was a big fan of his. I was giving him a shout out everywhere I could and saying we need to sign this guy. But with Simon Maguire, I think that was a good signing. He seems to fit in well. He's settled into the club. He's settled into the defence. He seems to be organising us. And I think we're at a position now where I don't think we need Koulibaly. I think as good of a player as he is, I don't think we need him in this United side. I think we seem to be getting a bit of a settled back four. De Gea seems good this season. Wan-Bissaka, Maguire, Lindelof at the minute is a bit hit and miss. But I think once Twinzebe comes back, and I think that's the key, I don't think we need another centre-half. I think in the summer, okay, maybe we need to bolster our options if the likes of Rojo, Phil Jones, I know Chris Mullin's out on loan, if they get ships out, we might need to bring some more players in. But I think Maguire and Twinzebe, I think that is a partnership for the long term, and I think that is the one that a lot of United fans want to see right now.
Yeah, that's the key thing, like you said there, it's Twinzebe, isn't it? It's whether he comes in and performs to the level that he needs to perform, because for me, like you mentioned, that back five, if we're going to call it, with De Gea, yep, solid, absolutely no problems there. Wan-Bissaka, yep, brilliant. Luke Shaw, Brandon Williams, solid, absolutely fine with that. Harry Maguire, yep, not a problem. It's just that other position. And Victor Lindelof, I've said it numerous times, not for me, not, I mean, look, he's a number two centre-back, and I mean that in the sense of, what, you'd call it a number three centre-back, I suppose. Marcus Rojo, the same, fits into that category, as does Phil Jones and Chris Smalling. So to have another pillar alongside Harry Maguire, I quite like the thought of signing Koulibaly, but I also want that English homegrown Manchester United through the ranks player like Axel Tuanzebe to come good. So yeah, it could impact that. However, it could also be a good signing, which I'm sure you have many more of, Ben, because you have drawn up some of your January transfer targets. Hit me.
I've got my transfer list and I'm ready for that director of football role.
There we go.
If Ed's listening in. Yeah, I think we've mentioned Koulibaly and I don't think it's the defence that we need to be making additions to. I think if we're realistic, okay, we've spent quite a bit of money in the last few years, but in terms of net spend, it's not been up there with the biggest teams in the world. So I think if we're going to go and spend 100 million on a defender, I think that doesn't leave a lot of money in the budget for a lot of the other positions. So I focus mainly on the attacking positions, midfield, and I think we desperately need another centre forward, which is the first name on my list, is I'd say a dream transfer target for January, possibly more so in the summer, is Timo Werner. I know we mentioned him a couple of weeks back for RB Leipzig, and I just think he is the perfect player United need to be signing right now. He's at RB Leipzig, so he's gettable in terms of his stature in the Bundesliga. He's not at a Bayern Munich. He's not at a Borussia Dortmund. Okay, RB are going for the league title this season. I think they're just a 4 points behind Borussia Mönchengladbach that are winning that title at the minute. So I think he is a bit of a, maybe not for January, but I think I've looked at his stats this season. And you're looking at it, and he's got, in 11 games, 11 goals and 4 assists. Not bad, is it, really? Add that to last season, he got 19 goals and 10 assists, and most of them are coming inside the box. He's scored 8 goals this season just inside the penalty area. So he seems to be a real finisher. He's very quick. He can play on the counter-attack. He can play all along the front line. So I think he would be a perfect signing for how Solskjaer wants to set up this United side. He's going with quick attackers. He's going from back to front very fast. I think Timo Werner needs to be at the top of that transfer list.
Interesting. Yeah, it was Florian Plettenberg we had on, wasn't it? The German football correspondent. And he said, actually, because he had that opportunity, that window of opportunity to prove himself on the world stage at the 2018 World Cup last year. And he didn't really do it. But what Florian said was, do you know what? It was probably a good thing because it meant that he got another year at Leipzig and is now really coming of age. Because before that, yes, he was pretty much 1-2, I think, for Leipzig in the Bundesliga. But like you said, 11-11, very impressive.
Yeah, and I think, look, we're short up front. We are. Martial has been injured this season, coming in and out of the team and in out of form. Rashford looks more comfortable on that left-hand side. Dan James looks more comfortable on either wing. So I think we are desperate for a striker. I know Rich before was mentioning Mandzukic, but I just think, can we really be signing a player that's of that age and that hasn't really kicked a ball this season? I think if we're doing that, then we're just trying to stopgap it. And my personal opinion would be I'd rather put trust in the likes of Mason Greenwood, even Chong that we mentioned before, rather than get an ageing player in there that's going to come in and sort of disrupt the squad a little bit, you don't know. And I mean, no one's really in for him, are they? So I think that says a lot. When you talk about players, the players that are really worth anything, they've normally got a lot of transfer rumours about them, and I've not heard one other club apart from United that are in for Mandzukic.
Yeah, absolutely. The only problem with Werner, of course, is that he seems to be quite pally with a certain bespectacled Liverpool gaffer. But we'll move on from that. Next one?
Next one, I'm going to go... I know James Maddison has been mentioned a lot recently in terms of United transfer links. I don't think he's gettable in January. So whether that's something United look for the summer, if we've got Champions League football, I think he's a very good player. I think you saw a brief cameo when he came off for England the other night, and he looks comfortable at that level as well. So I think he would add a wealth of talent to that United midfield. But I'm going to mention another player that we've just actually seen on the screen before, Bruno Fernandes, playing for Portugal. I think he scored as well. And that is all you want from a goal-scoring midfielder. I think this United team lacks creativity. You've seen it this season. I know we've missed Pogba a lot, but I think we've got to be planning now for a United team without Pogba. I don't think he'll be here this time next year in a United shirt. So I think we need to be looking at attacking midfielders, and I think Bruno Fernandes fits the bill. I'll just read out, I've literally got a couple of stats here. 5 goals, 5 assists in 10 games this season. Add that to last season, 20 goals, 13 assists. They're all in the league, just league games. So you're thinking, you're getting a player that's, and I know it's the Portuguese league, but we haven't got a bad history buying players from the Portuguese league, minus Bebe. So I think he's a player that I think United will link with him in the summer. I don't know why we didn't go in for him. I don't know why anyone didn't go in for him. He's a captain, he's a leader. I think he would add something a bit different to this United squad. We could play him in an attacking midfield role. He could come into a 3 in midfield. I think he would be absolutely ideal in January.
Yeah, he broke records, didn't he, last year, I think, for being the top scoring midfielder in that league ever, or at least for a long, long time. So, yeah, we just saw, obviously, he scored the first goal against Luxembourg today. A great player, but then it then falls into that debate of what will happen with United's midfield, whether Paul Pogba stays or whether he goes. We're speaking to Andrew Flint later, all about Fred and the emergence of Fred, of course, and the fact that really his position, and he was, you know, he saw him a lot playing for Shakhtar, and it's not about the fact that he can be a foil for Pogba, it's the fact that he can actually play in that Pogba role. So that's a debate to be had. Andreas Pereira, of course, in there at the moment, but you're right, a midfielder is probably needed in January. Whether Sporting would be willing to let him go in January, you don't know. It would be costing a lot of money, but summer, yep, definitely a realistic target.
Yep, and I think both them players, Fernandes and Werner, have mentioned there's been rumours going about that they have got release clauses in the contracts. Now, I don't know myself what the release clauses are, but for Werner, it's been banded around about 30, 35 million. So I think you're talking fees in this day and age, and that is an absolute snip. But yeah, I'll just give a mention to a couple of other players that I think should be on United's radar. And when we're talking January, ideal January, but I think we need to be looking long-term as well. And okay, these Mandzukic, Emre Can, I think you can't be signing them sort of players because they might sort the situation out for 2 weeks, but 2 years down the line, they won't be in a United shirt. So there's no point in signing players like that. I think I like Ruben Neves of Wolves. Wolves midfielder. He's not been mentioned a lot really in terms of transfer targets, but I mean, he always seems to score against us. So I think that'd help us out a little bit on that front. But he's a defensive midfielder, so I think he'd work in that role if we're talking about Matic leaving as well. His passing stats and stuff are always up there. And, I mean, long shots. Jeez, when that guy has a shot from outside the box, it stays hit, doesn't it? And free kick delivery as well. He's top drawer on that respect. And then another player, Jadon Sancho. I mean, he's on the top of everyone's transfer list. if you talk about world football. So I think that one we're hoping is a summer transfer target, but I think that all depends on whether United get Champions League football or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And that one would indeed be controversial, of course. Came through the ranks at Man City, but tearing it up in the Bundesliga with Borussia Dortmund and with England too, of course. Nice transfer targets there, Ben. I'm sure we'll come back onto those a bit later. But for now, it is the Manchester United Fan Show. We are going to be reflecting on a former player next.
From Ali to Zaha, we've got it covered. Love Sport Radio.
Makeda's first touch and he plays in Nani. Nani going through here, tries a little chip. What a goal! The most delicate of finishes from Nani. Nani, away from Mata. Still Nani. Nani! Oh, brilliant! You could watch it again and again and again. Utterly outstanding from Nani, and United lead 2-0. Sprinting through and he threw. Nani gets the better of company. He can win the Community Shield here for Manchester United. It's Nani! Now Nani, he unleashes one. Oh, what a goal! What a strike! Nani's first for Manchester United is a scorcher! And what about that for a celebration? Do not try that at home!
Ugh, it just brings a tingle to your spine. The hairs on the back of your neck do stand up because Nani is turning 33 today. The former Manchester United player, of course, brought in from Sporting Lisbon back in 2007 alongside Anderson at the time. Owen Hargreaves came in at the time as well. A big summer of spending for Sir Alex Ferguson after winning that first title, of course, in 3 years in 2006-07. Getting it back from Chelsea and going on to win three in a row. And, of course, Nani did play a big part in that. He's 33 today, Ben. Just listening to those clips there, I mean, a few of them stuck out for me, and those goals that we picked in particular, and they are from the Manchester United YouTube channel, of course, by the way. The Community Shield one against Man City. Listen, I know that ended up in City winning the league in the fashion that they did with Sergio Aguero on that final day against QPR, but that first game of the season in the Community Shield, the curtain raiser, I was at that. And it was David De Gea's, obviously his first game in English football, and City going 2-0 up at the break and United fighting back to win 3-2. And I was at that end when he nicked that ball off company and just ran half the length of the pitch, rounded Joe Hart and put it in. The feeling was just, I don't think you've ever had anything like that at a Community Shield before or since.
No, not at all. Just that rivalry. I remember that game and just thinking at half time, because I remember the summer being a summer where I think we just won the league, but it was like, where do we go from here? Have we brought the right players in? I know, like I said, De Gea coming in, but did he look good for English football? There was a lot of questions about that United team at the time, and a lot of questions of Fergie as well. And I think at half time, when we were 2-0 down and then managed to come back, it just gave you that belief that, oh, hang on, we're okay here. And I know the season didn't end up how we wanted it to end up, but we played some really good football in that game. And I remember Nani linking up very well with Tom Cleverley.
Yep.
And the little 1-2s, and you're thinking, yeah.
Yeah, seeing Tom Cleverley come in. Phil Jones as well, making his debut for United in England. So, yeah, just some great memories. The Spurs goal was on there, the one where they said, what a hit. Now, that one was a crucial goal, because that was his first season, actually. United had gone three games unbeaten at the start of the campaign, and it wasn't looking too great. Of course, the opening day was that 0-0 Bordeaux draw with Reading. Had quite a few injury problems. And it was late on in that game against Spurs at Old Trafford, and he rifled one in, which he tended to do a lot. The Chelsea goal was in that, Juan Mata getting a bit of a mention because he rounded Juan Mata and put that one in. That was the game where Fernando Torres missed from like 2 yards after rounding David De Gea. But he did score some fantastic goals. He was filled with promise, and it's quite sad, really, to see how it panned out for him at United, because he just, I don't know, it's a real difficult one to judge. He was given a 5-year contract, by the way. When David Moyes took over, he was given a 5-year contract, and he did say in an interview a few years back that he thought, right, this is a defining moment for me in my career, it's going to be brilliant. And it turned out, he said, to be an absolute disaster, because Moyes didn't fancy him, Louis van Gaal didn't fancy him. Of course, he was shipped out back on loan to Sporting Lisbon, his old club at the time. Then he moved to Fenerbahce, and then it sort of upturned for him again. Moved to Valencia, had a starring role for Portugal in the 2016 Euros, actually took the captaincy after Ronaldo went off early in the game. So it did sort of come back for him, playing in MLS now, but it's just quite sad that he didn't really fulfil his true potential at United?
No, and I think you mentioned his career after United. I think that'll be a quiz question, won't it, on pub quizzes coming down the line on the amount of clubs he's had. But yeah, Nani's a weird one. I think he just has the unfortunate thing of being a Portuguese winger that we signed from Sporting Lisbon. I think the comparisons with Ronaldo really started quite early on, especially when we signed him, and it was like, oh, have we found another one here? Another one of Cristiano Ronaldo. But I think he was a good player. You mentioned that Chelsea game. I remember being at that game, and that goal was incredible, and as incredible as the Fernando Torres miss. But yeah, he was a good player, Nani. I think, especially under Sir Alex Ferguson, I mean, there wasn't many bad players under him, but he really brought some exciting to the game. You knew when he was playing that he'd bring something a bit different. And I remember him, was it a game against Arsenal where he did their headers on his... he did about basically keepy ups, but with his head, wasn't it?
It was the FA Cup clash, wasn't it? The 4-0. That was the 07-08 season. That was his first season as well. Like, really showboating in that campaign. And he always seemed to play quite well against Arsenal, actually. I remember the game away from home, which, bizarre stat, was the first game to be 3D. So I actually did a feature on that for a magazine at the time, and I had to go to this pub, and everybody was handed 3D glasses. And he'd been in and out of the team, and I remember there was just a moment, and the guy standing next to me after it, he said, I just knew he was going to do something here. And I think he like Cruyffed his way through two defenders and then chipped one over Almunia, yes, right on the ankle. It was given as an own goal, but really a great goal from Nani. And he had that in his locker. He had that chip in his locker. And actually, it was the following season where I said to you off air, I had no idea he was voted Players Player of the Year in the 10-11 season when United got that title. The 19th, I think it was. Yeah, 19th title.
I think that shocked us both when you said that, and he was player of the season, because I think when you talk about that United side and the great players that were in it, Nani doesn't always come to mind. But I think he was, you mentioned the games against Arsenal, I think he was a bit of a big game player. I think he did turn up in those big games. And I remember even very on in his United career, that Champions League final that we won against Chelsea going to penalties. And just the fact that he came up and had the courage enough to go and take a pen and stick it in. And I think he just seemed to have that self-belief that you need. He always seemed to have that chop back onto his right foot, and then the dink as well, the chip. And I think, yeah, you like seeing players like that just brought a bit of excitement, especially when you're at the ground. They're the players that you want to go and watch, the players that get you up off your seat, that might, all right, he might have gone and beat four players, and then in the next 2 seconds, he probably kicked it out for a throw-in. But... He just brought something a bit different to that United side, and a bit more dynamism that you need.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that just to finish on him, he was one of those players that you were always willing to do well. You always thought, right, come on, Nani, you've got to do it now. You've got to be that new Ronaldo that we want you to be. He had a good season this season, to be fair. 12 goals in 30 for Orlando City in MLS. Right, Nani, 33 today. Happy birthday, boss. Next up, we're going to be looking ahead to the game with Sheffield United next week. We've got Ian Rans from a United View blog on the line.
Giving your team a voice. Love Sport Radio.
This is the Manchester United fan show here on Love Sport. Almost forget what I was doing there for a second. It's because I was looking and in complete shock that Sheffield United are, of course, in fifth in the Premier League at the moment. That is who United travel to next weekend when the Premier League resumes. And on the line now, we have Ian Rans of a United View blog. Ian, the high-flying Sheffield United host the Minnows of Manchester United next weekend.
Well, that's something I don't think any Blade would have expected to be said at this stage of the season, to find us where we are, but I'll take those words quite happily.
I mean, coming into the season, no one really would have expected this to be a game, I guess, where you would have said United could potentially slip up at Bramall Lane. But the way that Sheffield United are playing this season, especially the fast-paced nature of Chris Wilder's approach, suggests that, listen, the form has been arguably better away from Bramall Lane than it has been at home this season. But this is a team who narrowly lost to Liverpool had it not been for a Dean Henderson error on the day. So they're going to give United a game.
I think United will give Manchester a game, absolutely. I mean, for me, I think the away form is clearly great. We've not lost away since January. And I think every game we're playing in is very tight. We've not lost by more than one goal since last August. So whatever way you look at it, it'll be a competitive game. And I think our probably home form and, the results probably belie the performances at home. Again, you know, like you say, we lost by that single goal to Liverpool with Henderson's mistake, beat Arsenal and lost narrowly to Leicester and Southampton as well. So there's never been much in these games at all, really. And I think we're showing that, for now, certainly, we can compete and adapt to life at the Premier League.
Ian, just a note on the actual football that your team are playing at the minute. I think a lot of clubs in the Premier League will be, United maybe included, be a bit jealous of how Chris Wilder's got you playing. But that's nothing new, the style of play you're playing, is it?
It's the way we've been playing for the last 3 years. And I think it's, if you look at the way in which the players, we've got players here with us who've come on that journey from League One in John Flake, Jack O'Connell, Chris Basham. We've got a way of playing that the players understand their role in, and it's effective, but also it's probably the best football I've watched in 40 years of watching Sheffield United.
Do you know what I love as well about Chris Wilder, Ian, is that he doesn't get carried away. He's very down to earth. He's very matter of fact after games. And I think a lot of new managers, or perhaps the attitude towards newly promoted teams, when you lose against a big side, from the media's perspective and the opposing manager's perspective, sometimes is, oh, well, don't worry, you gave it a good go. Whereas he's like, no, we deserve to win the game. I've given the lads a rollicking in there because they should be winning that. He did the same for Dean Henderson after that mistake against Liverpool. He said, you know, yeah, I will pat him on the back, but at the same time, this is a lad who wants to play for England. He wants to play for Manchester United, so he needs to learn to get rid of that from his game.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it gets some kind of mixed comments in some quarters. I think his blunt honesty, but you know, I think the club spirit he creates, the understanding of the players, and the players clearly want to play for him. He's got an interesting style in that, you know, if players haven't worked out over the last 2 or 3 years, he moves them on very quickly and replaces and looks to how he improves the team. And you know, the Dean Henderson criticism after the Liverpool mistake is exactly what Chris levelled at Dean Henderson after his mistakes probably cost us, you know, 3 points when we were coasting to victory at Villa Park, sort of February, March time last season. We then went on an unbeaten run to the end of the season in which Dean Henderson played a key role. He knows how to bring the best out of his players, and I think, although it got criticism at the time, most Blades fans were quite happy with his approach, really.
Speaking of Dean Henderson, just quickly, of course, currently a Manchester United player. I'm presuming in the loan deal he won't be playing next weekend.
He's not now.
So that's quite a big loss for the Blades, isn't it?
It is, and it's interesting. I think he's going to be an excellent keeper. He's still learning. He'll still make mistakes. There's some general confidence about, you know, his general confidence borders on arrogance, which, you know, for any footballer can, and especially a goalkeeper in the position he's in, means that, you know, that can lead to some of the daft mistakes and errors of judgment he's made. But we've got a competent replacement in Simon Moore, not played at this level, I don't think, when he was at Cardiff, but certainly a goalkeeper that United fans would trust to come in and hopefully, you know, play in the same mould as Dean has this season.
This season must have been, I mean, literally a dream to be where you are at this stage of the season. But where do you see Sheffield United ending up at the end of this season?
I think, first of all, now, I made a comment on our podcast this week that, you know, I'm still looking down to 18th. You know, it's 8 points, 19 goal difference, you know, so, sorry, 9 points and 18 goal difference, so it's as good as 10 points. That is the first aim, is to just make sure we stay up and build on what we've got. I always had a feeling we would be safe this season, and that's not trying to be arrogant, but I think it reflects the confidence I've got in the manager and the way he plays, and you know, there's comments to say we'll be found out at some point. Our style of play will be found out. I think Wilder's smarter than that, and he's adapted over the course of the last three and a bit seasons he's been in charge. You know, we didn't start out playing this way when he came in. He kind of landed on it after we'd lost, you know, three of the first four games he was in charge. So I think it's important. You know, he's the man who could actually he's key. He's key to this as any other player we've got in that team.
Yeah, and of course, football didn't start when the Premier League started in 1992, Ian, but a lot of stats did. And I'm sure you know what I'm going to say, because I would imagine over the course of the next week, this fixture, this particular game, is going to get dredged up over and over again. Of course, the first ever goal scored in the Premier League, Brian Deane, August 92, against Manchester United for Sheffield United, and a victory on that day. Were you at Bramall Lane then?
I was, yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, absolutely fantastic header, and it's one that's kind of sort of etched into Blades legend the way Ryan just hung in the air and flicked it in past past Schmeichel. And then obviously he scored the second goal as well, put through by Alan Cook at the opposite end in front of the Manchester United fans. So, yeah, an absolutely wonderful day. And, you know, we've had some good fixtures against Manchester United over the years. I think there was a cup tie later that season, which we won 2-1 at Bramall Lane as well. Cantona scored probably one of the best goals I've seen by the opposition, chipping Alan Kelly in the cup, I think a season or two seasons later. Yeah, so we've had some great matches, and hopefully next Sunday will be another.
That Cantona chip, I love that, because wasn't that... I mean, that particular game was used as the footage, wasn't it, for the When Saturday Comes film with...
Yes, we had the half-time joy of watching Sean Bean trying to take a penalty for about 20 minutes.
Sean Bean, brilliant. Ian, it's been great having you on, mate. Just before you go, a quick score prediction.
I'm going to say Sheffield United will win 1-0.
1-0 to the Blades. Ian, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
No problem.
Cheers,
thanks,
Ian.
That was Ian Rands from A United View, a blog and podcast they run. Really good talking to him, and really good actually thinking about those former fixtures between United and Sheffield United. By the way, it's funny, isn't it? When you hear another fan say United, you're like, no, they're not talking about Manchester United. Of course, there's only one United, but... of course, Sheffield United refer to the team as United, as do West Ham as well. But it is funny when you speak to someone, especially on the Man United fan show, and they say United, you get a little bit confused. But yes, those former fixtures at Bramall Lane. United won when Sheffield United were last in the Premier League in 2006-07, 2-1 on that day. And then a couple of 3-0 victories, I remember, in the 93-94 season. But of course, that first ever goal in the Premier League scored by Brian Deane. Your view on this one, Ben?
It's a tough game, isn't it? I think you can't overlook it. I think the football they've been playing this season is incredible, by no mean feat at all. I think it'll be a tight one. I'll back the Man United of the two Uniteds, and I think we might just scrape it, but I think it'll be very tight.
Yeah, it will indeed. Just another note, by the way, on this game. There's always been a bizarre FA Cup connection between United and Sheffield United, in that often when the two teams meet, United make the final. And I mean Manchester United. 2015-16, it was that terrible game when Rooney scored a last-minute penalty, I think, in injury time. Before that, 94-95, United won the third round. Then that was the game that he was referring to, that Eric Cantona chip that went in off the bar. Brilliant goal, that one. 2-0 victory on that day, a blustery Bramall Lane. I remember United got to the final that year, lost to Everton in the final, Paul Rideout. And then also in the 89-90 season, United met Sheffield United in the FA Cup. Third round, I think it was, again, got to the final. Alex Ferguson's first trophy.
I tell you what, you're the guy that everyone needs in a pub quiz, aren't you?
Yeah, not bad on that. There's a little gap, though. I tell you what, modern history, terrible. But go back to the 90s, I'm your man. Right, this is the Man United Fan Show on Love Sport. We've got another hour coming up.
We've all got one, and we're not afraid to put it on display. Our opinions, that is. Share yours now at Love Sport Radio on Twitter or call us 0208 70 20 558. Love Sport Radio, your fan station.
Round two of the Manchester United Fan Show coming up. We're with you through to 11 p.m. this evening. Me, Matt Beadle, here with Ben Senior. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
We are going to talk about a certain individual now who has taken the mantle in the middle of the park for Manchester United. He's been in the starting 11 for the past five successive games. Now, this is a guy who failed to make any of the first four matchday squads in the Premier League for United. He said that he's in the happiest moment of his life since he came to England. This is a much maligned player who people don't think can make the grade, £52 million, but is just starting to show he's got a bit of potential.
It's like we've signed a new player in the last 2 weeks, isn't it? He just seems to have all of a sudden found that partnership with McTominay in that central midfield. I know it's probably due to injuries that he's come in, but yeah, these past few weeks he seems to be that all-action midfielder that we are looking for. And all right, let's not get too carried away, but he goes about the pitch. He's energetic. He seems to be good on tackles, getting the ball back and then passing it on. And I think when he does the simple stuff well, I think that's when he's most effective. I think when he tries to go and take on about 2-3 players, I think that's where he gets lost a bit. But yeah, he's looking good at the minute, Fred.
Yeah, and like I said, they started the past five fixtures for United. Four of those have been won. And listen, there is a debate as to whether he is better with or without Paul Pogba. And we spoke to Andrew Flint, a senior writer at Football Grad Network. A really, really good chat this was earlier today. He has seen a lot of Fred during his time with Shakhtar in the Ukraine. Spent about 5 years there, made over 100 appearances for the club, was highly rated. Yes, there was some debate as to whether he should have cost £52 million, but Andrew in particular is thrilled to bits at the impact that Fred is now having.
Well, I'm personally delighted to see him getting a run in the side because, I mean, out in Ukraine, it's a completely different world, obviously, football-wise, and Shakhtar are so utterly dominant that in some ways it's hard to judge quite how adaptable a player is. But just purely on the pitch, when Fred is confident, he's honestly one of the most exciting players to watch. And I've been so upset to see him basically stagnate at United. And I don't think anybody could really have been that excited over how he's done the first 12 months at least at United. I have my own personal views as to why it's not worked out, and certain ways he's been used and the expectation on him and the time it takes to adapt to a new league as well. So there are a number of factors, but I think he has the potential to be an extremely useful player for United. And I think the fact that Solskjaer is patient with him is a good sign.
Well, it's really interesting you say that because he came in for around £52 million from Shakhtar. And this is a guy, like you said, highly rated. I think a lot of United fans thought, OK, here we go. Here's the guy to potentially free up Paul Pogba, because this is all we've heard since Paul Pogba came, is that United needed that midfield duo, perhaps. Nemanja Matic was there. Andreas Pereira was there. We know now Scott McTominay is there. It's all about freeing up Paul Pogba. But Fred has almost adopted that Pogba role. So when you say he can be really exciting, what did you see from him at Shakhtar that suggests he's got what it takes to succeed in the Premier League?
Well, I think this is the most awkward part of it, because you mentioned that taking up the role that Pogba played. I think that, annoyingly, is actually where he's most effective. At Shakhtar, he played under two very different managers. Maciej Luchescu was he's a very rigid, set in his ways sort of manager. He was there for 12 years, 13 years, and he won almost every single title he could have won. And his style of play was very systematic. Luchescu went on to Zenit St. Petersburg and failed because he was too rigid. The players he had didn't buy into his attitude. Fred did. He was relatively defensive in the sense that he didn't contribute a lot to forward passing into the final third. But under Paulo Fonseca, who was a far more adventurous coach, who incidentally said, I see his best position as the attacking of the two in a 4-2-3-1. And that's where he was most effective at Shakhtar. He still didn't contribute a huge number of goals and assists, but that's not what United fans should look for from him. You mentioned about, you know, the whole freeing up Pogba conundrum. That has been built up so much that I think people just assume any other central midfielder in United's squad, that's the role they have to play. But that's not the role Fred ought to be playing. So, you know, at Shakhtar, the best thing I could really say about him was the fact that even out of possession, he was extremely, extremely hardworking. And I don't mean that in a, you know, water-carrying sense. I mean it more in the sense that he was very proactive. He never switched off. His passing was very accurate, but very quick and very progressive. And that's been one of my main frustrations with United. The pace at which they pass has been lethargic at best over, you know, barring the last month or two, I suppose it's improved a lot. But it's been a common complaint, and that's something Fred can change, but he has to be able to do it. And when he's serving alongside Pogba rather than in the Pogba role, there's not so much he can do. But I think he can show more now that he's got a bit more license to be on the ball, basically.
Well, that's it right there, isn't it? And you mentioned there that he played in a 4-2-3-1 under Paulo Fonseca at Shakhtar. He's kind of playing in that system now, playing alongside Scott McTominay in the base, I suppose, of that 4-2-3-1. There have been some people suggesting that the pace of English football has been a factor in the fact that Fred hasn't been able to adjust to life. Do you think that's fair, that the pace is maybe been too quick for him, or a bit of a rude awakening since he first arrived?
Well, I would say it's something slightly different. I mean, the pace is different, certainly. And I think it has been a factor in how long it's taken him to adapt. But I would say it's more about the amount and the type of possession that he's enjoyed. you know, at Shakhtar, the only real rival you have is Dynamo Kiev. And even then, Shakhtar have been so utterly dominant the last decade, 10, 12 years even, that almost every single domestic game you go in knowing you're going to have 65, 70% possession and you're going to have so much time on the ball, you've got to break down very packed defensive lines, but you're going to have time on the ball to do it. And at United, especially under Solskjaer, the way he likes to break quickly, it's a very, very different type of possession and sometimes percentage of possession as well. You know, the time on the ball is less than he's used to. So, yes, I think the pace is a factor, but I think it's more the type of possession that he's had to adapt to. But I think he's starting to show where he's more useful, which is when he is trusted a little bit more. And I think alongside McTominay, it's the perfect foil. Now, I think the real question is what happens when Pogba is back, fully fit, available, and you have McTominay, Fred and Pogba. It's very, very hard to leave out Paul Pogba, obviously. McTominay's been one of the best performers this season. So where does that leave Fred? And I think it's a difficult one to work out. But the pace has been a factor, certainly. But I think the amount of possession is different too. So he's learning, but he's getting there, I think.
And you mentioned goals there and assists. I think that's part of the problem with the modern game in particular, is that we constantly look at stats and you see fans dropping in graphics here and there, media outlets dropping in graphics here and there. Look at the amount of assists and goals and the pass completion that player has got. We know that ultimately that's not an accurate way, really, of showing what a player can do. And with regards to Fred, assists and scoring hasn't been a big part of his game. And I know he's come out recently and said, you know, I need to add more goals to my game. But I think that is part of the feeling as well. When you don't see those numbers next to the words assists and goals, he never scored that many goals for Shakhtar in his time there. So I guess as soon as people start to look past that, they might actually begin to see what a player Fred can be.
Yeah, I 100%. I completely agree. I think his best attributes are not necessarily in the final third. But one thing I've noticed as well is McTominay has progressed, in my view, fantastically in the last few months. And he's confident. Once Fred gets the confidence, and more importantly, once he develops an understanding alongside McTominay as a partnership, and I do see those two as a potential partnership, I think Fred will feel a bit more confident to actually get forward, and his numbers will start to increase. I think if you really do want to go down the line of statistics, more important statistics are forward passes than assists and goals, because that's what his job should be. When you've got a forward line with the pace of Daniel James and Marcus Rashford and Anthony Martial, you know, those are the players who should be getting the numbers in and around the box. Fred, once he gets the confidence, I think he will start to venture forward a bit more. And I think, in fact, I don't think you need to label him or McTominay as the more defensive of the two, because I think they're both confident enough on the ball to play the right sort of positive passes. I don't think there's any need to label him as a defensive or as an attacking midfielder. Fred has played all sorts of roles in midfield. He's capable. So allowing him the freedom to pick and choose the moments when to press, when to drop back, that will be the key to getting the best out of him.
And just to finish on the stats as well, I believe in the Champions League in the season before he came to United, more passes, and more tackles than any other Shakhtar player. So again, that sort of gives you an insight into the type of player he is. Andrew, I just want to very quickly touch on something that's become a bit of a legendary tale, perhaps a bit of a myth since he arrived in England. And that is the news that apparently when United faxed or emailed or whatever it is that they do now to submit an offer to another team, that £52 million offer to Shakhtar, there was absolute hilarity in the boardroom at the time. Paulo Fonseca and everybody else could not believe that United were willing to pay that much for Fred. Now, is there any truth into that, or is that just complete nonsense and it never happened?
Well, I mean, I'd be honest, I would have loved to have been a fly in the wall on the boardroom when they got the offer. So exactly what words were used would be very interesting to find out. But no, I mean, they were certainly surprised at the amount. But if you think about how it panned out, if you remember at the time, Manchester City made a fair amount of interest. They were looking into it very closely. And it was seen as United stealing in from under City's noses almost. But this is where Shakhtar are so, so smart. This is where this is why they've managed to get ahead so well. It's certainly in the transfer market. They've built up a reputation of building a home for Brazilian players and selling them on. There's no shame in that. The Ukrainian Premier League will never be at the level of a top five, top six European league, and to make a profitable living, they simply have to develop players and sell them on. But what they did so well was not ruling out any transfer to a big club, allowing the interest to develop, and not necessarily a bidding war, but they also recognised that one of United's biggest failings in the last 3-4 years has been their just utterly appalling, naive approach to the transfer market, throwing huge amounts of money that a lot of European clubs know they had. So I wouldn't quite say it was hilarity, but they were aware of what they could exploit. They did it, and they got the most they could for him. I mean, he was the best player in the Ukrainian Premier League. He was the most effective, he was the most dangerous, the most valuable. And if you think about the sort of prices in the transfer market at the time, when you see how effective he was, how influential he was, that's what you're buying. 50 million, it was about the sort of price you should be paying, really. Just because the Ukrainian Premier League is a less powerful league financially, with the draw that it has, other than for unproven players, it doesn't mean that a valuable player should not demand a high transfer fee. So Shakhtar knew what they were doing, basically. I don't think it was quite as hilarious as these stories were made out to be, but they certainly were grateful, shall we say, that they had found the right buying club.
Interesting. Shakhtar certainly knew what they were doing. Perhaps you could argue Mr. Ed Woodward certainly did not know what he was doing. But that is a matter certainly for another day. I'm sure we'll talk about that many times on the Man United Fan Show. Andrew, it's been great having you on. Just before you go, in summary, and I suppose you've kind of answered this question throughout the past 10 minutes or so, but what do you see happening now for Fred? I know Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has put extreme faith in him, saying he's going to play a part in the immediate future. Fred has repaid that faith and actually gone back and said, look, Ollie's made me feel really comfortable here. I know I need to do more, but I'm starting to feel good. In fact, he said he's feeling better now than he's ever felt since moving to England. So moving forward for Fred, what can you envisage coming? Do we see a potential United superstar in the making here?
If I really had to put my neck on the line and say yes or no, I think he will be a success. And the reasons are fairly simple in my mind. He is capable of playing more than one midfield role. He's had more time to adapt to both the pace of the league and his teammates around him. And if we look further ahead in the future, then Paul Pogba's future, it wavers every 6 months or so between noises about wanting to leave and then a run of good form. And there's only so long that is going to last. And I'm not saying I think Paul Pogba will leave, but the roles he plays may change. And I'm not saying that's for the worst. Perhaps the best outcome would be having a Fred McTominay midfield with Paul Pogba further forward, and then have Rashford, Martial and Dan James as the attacking three. And I think that really is a genuinely useful outcome all round, even up to board level, because midfield has been the problem area for some time, I would argue. Now that Harry Maguire's come in defence, the defence is looking a little bit more stable. But central midfield has always been the problem. Well, Fred could be the answer to that without needing to go into the transfer market. So it's going to take a lot of faith, a lot of development for Fred, but he certainly has the ability. His confidence is growing under Solskjaer. Whatever criticism tactically Solskjaer's had, he is very good personally, man on man, to build up confidence of players. And that's what Fred's needed. So now he's getting that. I say the next 6 months are very, very important for Fred's Manchester United career. But I actually believe that the best answer would be put faith in him and see what he can do.
For the fans, by the fans. Love Sport Radio.
The Manchester United Fan Show here on Love Sport with me, Matt Beadle, and Ben Senior. Ben, we heard from Andrew Flint just then, senior writer at Football Grad Network. Some really interesting stuff about Fred because, listen, he's seen a lot of him play in Ukraine for Shakhtar Donetsk. And what struck me most, and I think you could tell from that interview, was that he was saying Paul Pogba might even hinder Fred's development at United, and perhaps Fred would be a better player for United when Paul Pogba isn't in the side.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, every conversation about United has to include Paul Pogba in some way, doesn't it, with transfers especially. But I don't know, I don't see the two players being very similar. I think Fred and McTominay have worked that sort of axis at the centre of midfield quite, like, worked it out this season, and they seem to have what it takes to stop players and be good defensively. I think we do need something more going forward. I know we've tried it with Pereira in that number 10 role that's worked some occasions it's not. So I think Pogba, if he's going to come back this season, I think I see him being a bit further forward than Fred. So who knows, that could work out them three, or it could not. But I think Pogba long term won't be a Man United player. So I'd likely to agree with Andrew and say that I think Fred will be at the club a lot longer than Paul will.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when you then look at the formation, for example, if you're saying that United are, you know, you've got De Gea, you've got your back four, right? And then you're looking at Martial, Rashford, Daniel James up front, right? As that sort of permanent front three, effectively. Yes, if a striker comes in, that will chop and change, but you'd imagine he'd stick with the front three. So it is that midfield that is so crucial. If Paul Pogba does stay there, you know, what then? What is the midfield looking ahead for you? Because if Fred continues the form that he's currently been on, and listen, we talked about stats with Andrew just then, and his stats have never been great in terms of goals and assists. That's not what his game is all about. He says he wants to add that to his game. He hit the bar in the last outing, of course, against Brighton, in which he got man of the match. He's saying he wants to improve his game in that respect, but his pass completion, his duels won, his tackles won. And again, pass completion, a little misleading because, listen, you could have 90% pass completion in a game, but 80% of those could be hospital balls, you know, that you've given someone, but your pass has still been completed, but you've given it to someone in a whole load of danger. So I don't even know if pass completion can be looked at that closely. But if Paul Pogba does stay, right, you've then got room for, what, a few players that go into that midfield. Who would they be for you?
I think for me, it's McTominay and Fred. I think that's the three right there. I think Pereira has been too on and off this season to warrant a starting place every week. I think we need to add to it in January and in the summer. I think we really need to add to the midfield and have more creativity going forward. But I think at the minute, you can't really fault McTominay and Fred as a duo. I think you look at the team and what you look for are them sort of partnerships and then them link-ups. We've seemed to have formed it a little bit with the back four. Seems to be quite solid with Maguire in there. Like you say, three. They seem to be linking up nicely. I think it's just that midfield that we need to just really work out and I think have a solid formation going forward because we seem to be chopping and changing a lot this season. And at times, he's only played two in there. So that'll be interesting when we... What will be the real test is when we go into the big games in the second half of the season, if Pogba is fit, because Ollie's like to go with that 3/5 at the back and the two just in midfield and then you've got the pace up front. So that'll be interesting whether Pogba displaces Fred or whether he gets put on the bench.
Yeah, and you wonder what that would do for Fred's confidence if Paul Pogba suddenly just strolls back into the side. His cast is now off. We saw the Instagram post with the cast being removed from his leg. Every little detail has to be uploaded on Instagram or whatever it is, whatever platform it is they're using. But what I also found funny about Fred and his comments recently, he's not with Brazil. Of course, they played Argentina this week in a friendly. He's in Dubai, I think. I think he's gone on holiday with his wife and his kid in Dubai. He's feeding camels and stuff. He showed all of that on social media. But does seem happy, which is obviously a good thing. But it's almost schoolboy stuff in the sense that he was like, yeah, I need to work on my short passing. Ollie's told me that. And he's really open about that because there was the game. I can't remember which game it was now. It was at the height of the pitfalls for United when everyone said this is disgraceful, it's the worst start since the 89-90 season. And there was one particular game where he passed, it was a short pass to Pereira and it bobbled, or Pereira passed it to him and it was all over the place. But he's saying that he's working on his game now. So, I mean, is this a player for you? I mean, are you happy with Fred now? Are you happy to see him in the starting lineup moving forward?
I mean, at the minute, there's not a load of other options there. But the way he's playing, I can't fault him. The last few weeks, he has got it together. He just needs to, like you say, work on it properly and going forward, actually prove that he can be in this United side long term. Because at the minute, do I see United having a successful trophy-winning team with Fredin in it? I'm not convinced. So I don't know if we will be the United that we want to be with Fred in our team, but could he be in the squad? Could he be a squad player that comes in and does a job and provides that energy? I mean, we've lost it a little bit in the midfield since we let Ander Herrera go, and I think we really have seen that we've just lost that energy in midfield. The player that goes about is a bit all action, goes and flies into tackles and gets up for it and passes it forward. I think we've missed that since Herrera's gone. So I think Fred has to fill that void. He has to be in there to get amongst it. And recently, his actually passing has looked good. So I don't know. I'm torn at the minute. I think he's in the side right now. I think you can't fault him. He's been playing well with McTominay in there. But long term, I'm not sure he gets into a successful United 11.
Very interesting. Watch this space indeed. And also funny to hear what Andrew said about that story that the guys laughed when they got, it turns out it probably was true that they were like, crikey, I cannot believe they're putting this much money in for him. Ben, it's been great having you on. 11 games from now until the end of the year, so plenty of stuff to talk about on this, the Manchester United Fan Show. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, been a pleasure, mate.
Lovely stuff. This is the Manchester United Fan Show. We are going to be speaking to Paul Parker and hearing from Kevin Pilkington next.
From Ali to Zaha, we've got it covered. Love Sport Radio.
Good evening. This is the Manchester United Fan Show, not the Sunderland Fan Show. A slight error with our audio there, but this is the two-hour special Manchester United Fan Show. So don't go anywhere if you're a United fan, because we are speaking about United and not Sunderland. And it is the international break, which gave us the opportunity to branch out and speak to guys that perhaps we wouldn't always talk to on the Fan Show. And on this occasion, we caught up with Kevin Pilkington, of course, was the goalkeeper in that class of 92. Really, really good chat this. He was on the Goalkeepers Union podcast with myself and Richard Lee and spoke about his time at United. And he actually said that he was quite a lucky boy to be given the opportunity.
Yeah, I was. I was a lucky boy. I was at sixth form. I was there because I got a chance of playing for England schoolboys, and that's why I stayed on at sixth form. And I was playing some pro football. I was playing for a team called Harrogate United, and I got spotted there by Ray Medwall, who was a scout for Man United, and I got asked to go up for a trial at Man United for 3 weeks. And lucky enough, I did okay in the three games that I played. And then obviously went on and playing the class of 92, which was a wonderful experience. And to play with them players and then seeing what they went on and did in their careers is an incredible achievement for them, but an incredible experience for me to be involved in that group.
A lot is said about that team, that class, those players that came through. But one of the things that strikes me, every time that class of 92 comes up, if you were to look at the documentary, if you look at any literature, I saw a photo of 13 players in a photo call as if they're, you know, they're posing for a team photo. It was all outfield players. There's barely any mention of the goalkeeper from that time, which was yourself. Were you called up for the documentary? Because I noticed they had that big park game, didn't they, with all the players, with Raphael Burke and a few of the others.
I did get a call, but obviously with my job, I think we actually had a game that day. So you've got your priorities, which was obviously the job that you're doing at the time. So it would have been nice to have been there. But I've been quite lucky, to be honest. In the last few years, I've played a lot for the Legends team, which has been nice, and catching up with people doing that. So you miss out on it on some parts, but then on other parts, I went and played at Barcelona and played at the Nou Camp in front of 50,000 people, which against the likes of Ronaldinho and Rivaldo. And you're thinking, well, you thought that had all passed you by, and then to go and have the opportunity to go and play in the games like that, it's an absolute honour to be asked to go and play in them games again. So
how competitive are those Legends games? Is there still a sense of pride that you want to beat the other team?
There really is. There really is. I mean, we played against Liverpool in Stockholm, and the lads did not want to lose. No, especially against Liverpool, it was one of them, right, we're going to win this game, and we did. And there's still that once they get on that football pitch, there's still that competitiveness about the players.
A lot was always said about the initiations those players had to go through with the senior pros. Were you ever subjected to any of those in the dressing room?
Yeah, we all were. It was what happened in the changing room. To be honest, I think it made a lot of the lads a lot stronger and helped them grow into the actual career that they had.
In fact, this has got a lot worse now, because it used to always be that you have to sing when you went to a new club. That was always a standard kind of initiation. The problem now is that because of Instagram in particular and Instagram stories, every Friday night when I check Instagram and I check the stories, you can see somebody else singing. So all of a sudden, it's not just singing to the squad anymore, it's singing to the world.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The new lads always have to sing. There's an absolute worldies out there as well. We had Billy Walters come to us last year at Cambridge, and he absolutely blew the roof off the place. Really? He was incredible, yeah. So it's some lads you think, you look at them and they get up there and think, yeah, he's got a bit. But then others, you go, you're cringing forward and you're putting your jumper up over your head and going, oh, no, please stop.
what tended to happen, the lads that had nothing would always go for Wonderwall. They'd go for Oasis, where they could stay one tone. That was it. Go safe.
That's it. Well, Jimmy, our goalkeeper, is Bulgarian. He pulled out the Bulgarian national anthem.
Oh, amazing.
Yes. So it was terrible, bless him. I say that was like nowadays you're literally singing to the wall, to the world, that everyone's watching, and every Friday night you go, right, who's on now? Yeah, we had them sort of initiations, chatting up mops.
David Beckham on that documentary actually says that whilst you lot went through that and whilst it did build you, Nicky Butt says the same thing, you know, without it, you probably wouldn't have been the men that you came to be. But Beckham said that even though you'd gone through that, you were also a group that realised it needed to stop. Do you agree with that? Because we had Paul Robinson on the podcast a few weeks back and he said that it's maybe too easy for youth teamers now. They don't get that treatment, you know. The youth team players used to be almost in awe of their senior pros, whereas now sometimes they don't even give them the time of day.
Yeah, maybe the initiation should stop. But I think I agree there a little bit with it being easy for them. You used to have to do all your jobs. You had to clean the changing rooms, clean the toilets, have to do lads' boots, equipment and all that. And nowadays they don't have to do anything. And it's more standards than anything else. It's not so much the actual initiation of doing stuff, but it's giving people standards of how to behave and how to treat people. Like I say, nowadays, you're lugging kit around and lads just walk past them, just watching nowadays. And you look at senior pros carrying kit in and you're thinking, come on, just pick up a few bags or something like that. So I do think, I agree with Bex on the initiation bit, but I still think there should be jobs that they have to do just for the discipline and the standards of being a footballer.
Mm, yeah, I fully agree. Keen to get your thoughts on Eric Harrison. Of course, sadly passed away recently, and there's been an outpouring of, I suppose, positive comments towards him. Certainly Phil Neville described him as second father. Gary Neville said he was the man that made us. What were your memories of him and what impact did he have on you?
He was a fantastic man. I mean, it was a couple of weeks when I went up to his funeral, and you just saw by the amount of people that turned up to the funeral how well thought of he was. Incredible influence on us all. One of them that did drive the standards every single day. You can always remember the Fridays, right, him coming into the change room, just saying, right, get your studs on, get your shin pads on, we're having a proper game today. And then sort of a Friday before a game on a Saturday. And I think you've all heard the stories of him watching the games at the Cliff training ground and looking out the window and banging on the window and you're thinking, oh God, no, please no, please let not be me. And you knew he'd come down at half time and nail someone. But that was it. He'd come down, he'd nail you, and the next time he saw you, he'd be absolutely spot on with you. He'd be good as gold. He wanted good professionals. He wanted men around him as well. And when I found out that he died, I think a lot of comments were posted, and they're all similar. He didn't just build us as footballers. He built us as men as well. And so even if you didn't have a career in football, you would turn out to be a decent human being. Yeah, it was fantastic for every single player there. And more the defenders, I would say, the likes of Gary Neville, Phil Neville, Chris Casper, John O'Kane, he loved doing all that their sort of work. That's not taken away from everyone else because he was good at everything, really. But he loved going and working with them boys in the afternoons. And I mean, I think Gary would say himself that he wasn't a natural footballer. He worked really, really hard at his game. And to go on and have the career that Gary did, playing for Man United and for England, he knows that he owes Eric a hell of a lot to his career.
You mentioned Gary Neville there, Kev. Great pundit. He gets a lot of mentions on this podcast, primarily from Rich, yeah. I have to say.
Yeah. What for slaughtering goalkeepers?
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, that's it. I mean, his analysis of goalkeepers leaves a little to be desired. It has to be said. I'm interested Definitely. To know if he was as scathing towards you back in the day when you were players.
I think that was all left to Eric and the gaffer, Sir Alex, at the time. Senior pros would have a pop at you, but not so much the younger ones. But I agree with Rich on his punditry towards goalkeepers. I think it's a different position. It's a totally different position. You chuck someone in our position and they wouldn't have a clue what to do. Whereas, this is going to sound a bit cocky most probably, but I think if I went and played right back, I'd have a bit more of a clue about it than he would about being a goalkeeper.
Yeah.
It's a specialised position and it's one that they've never, ever, ever played in and they wouldn't have a clue about doing it. So they're saying about, say, a cross gets whipped in and, oh, yeah, you should come and deal with it, you should catch it instead of punching it. You've got point four, point five of a second to make that decision and you've got bodies around you. So I've been crying out for it for a while that you need a goalkeeper on that panel. Because they'll have strikers on there, they'll have defenders on there. And very rarely they'll have goalkeepers on that panel sitting there, and then they'll just hammer goalkeepers.
Where you get the... No.
I wonder who that could be.
No, I've been banging this drum for some time because it just... I mean, what tends to happen, I find, is that you get... It's very black and white. If a goalkeeper's beaten at his near post, then the pundit will blame the goalkeeper. If a goalkeeper flaps it across... If a cross is in the six-yard box, then, you know, certain rules of thumb that they have, which it's not a black and white position. There's so many different variations and reasons as to why goalkeepers do what they do. But the other part to it, and I guess you will experience this as well, is I know for a lot of goalkeeper coaches, it's then that relationship with the manager, because the manager will often have a similar analysis as to what a Gary Neville will have, because I don't know what it is, 97% of managers weren't goalkeepers or whatever the stat is. So, of course, they're turning around to the goalkeeper coach often, you know, what's he doing? Have you experienced that? And how do you deal with that if you have the manager turning around giving the same kind of comments that a Gary Neville would ordinarily give on TV, for instance?
Yeah, I have had that, especially when I first started coaching. I haven't actually said this, but I've heard a goalkeeper coach say this to his manager, saying, oh, yeah, if his goalkeeper messed up, he's like, oh, yeah, we practice that every day in training.
Yeah.
So, I'd love to come out and say that if the manager ever did say that. I don't think I'd have the balls to do it. I never comment on anything until I can see it, watch on the analysis, on the video analysis, because you go, maybe you can do better there, but I won't fully commit until I see it on the video and go, right, okay, yeah, he was or he wasn't. From where we're standing on the side of a pitch, you're in a totally different position, in totally different angles, and you haven't got a clue what's happened until you see it on a video properly. I think some managers said, I can't remember which manager it was, there's three or four mistakes before it gets to the goalkeeper in every single goal.
Yeah.
But if it goes in the back of that, they just point a finger straight at the goalkeeper.
Have you spoken to Gary Neville at all in recent times, dropped him a text or anything to say that was pretty shoddy analysis?
No. No, we're not on that level of friendship. Anytime I speak to him is whenever I see him at some of these games. So, no, not really. I'd like to every now and again, but leave him to it.
You could add my name to the bottom of that text as well.
Yeah. I think I can have a few of us down to the bottom of that list.
What was he like to work with, Schmeichel? Because you hear different reports. I've actually interviewed him and he was one of the loveliest guys I've ever met. But you hear from some ex-players as well who say he was a bit brash, he was a bit up himself, very difficult to work with. What was it like for you being a young keeper coming up to work with him, especially warming him up? Was that quite a daunting task?
Very. The warming up was the hardest task ever because he wanted perfection. You're hitting a volley at him and it was like just about a yard, half a yard to his left. He was like, I want it right at my face. I want it in my face. Yeah. But I can't speak high enough of the man. He was fantastic for me. Looked after me. I roomed with him quite a bit when I was around the first team. And yeah, he was brash. He was arrogant, but because he knew how good he was, and he backed it up. Personally, I've got no problem with people who are being arrogant, as long as they can back it up. Right. If they're arrogant and they've got nothing about them, then I can't deal with them. But if you've got that arrogance and you turn it in, week out, day in, day out, which he did. I mean, sometimes in training, I just sit on the bank at the cliff, and after we trained, we come back and the first team would still be training. And you'd sit on the bank at the cliff and you'd watch him, and lads wouldn't score past him. And then he'd start taking the mickey out of the lads and just like batting the ball back to them and going, go on, have another go, have another go. And some day you'd sit there for 10, 15 minutes and they'd be doing the shooting practice and no one would score. And it was that good. I really enjoyed it. It was my goalkeeping style was a little bit of him as well, because you watch him in training every single day, and that's how obviously you learn by watching other people, and it worked. And you're the first person to do the big spread that I saw. It's harsh on Casper, but a lot of that's rubbed off on Casper as well. Mm. But Casper's a good goalkeeper in his own right. Mm. But he's learned a lot from his dad, I'd say.
Do you know, I as a kid as well, Man United fan, so I used to then come to Old Trafford from time to time, and I'd always make a point to my dad, I need to be there at 2:05 latest so I can watch him warm up. And I used to love the warm-up he did with Brian Kidd, and it was quite, because he was always quite unorthodox in a lot of his ways. Certainly technically, I'd argue, looking back now, he was very unorthodox, often found himself landing on his front. Certainly when he dived, he wasn't at textbook, and he was always part of the warm-up he did. There was one where you mentioned him batting the ball back, where he'd
batting
do one
the ball back.
He'd do one with Brian Kidd, where Brian Kidd would come in 6-7 yards and keep firing it at him, and he just kept parrying it back over and over and over, which I've never seen since.
I can remember doing that warm-up with him as well, and that was his thing. Where he just wanted to knock the ball back and then you go and smash in the rebound.
Giving your team a voice. Love Sport Radio.
You're listening to the Manchester United fan show here on Love Sport. Ben Senior has left me in the studio, so I'm now flying solo. And actually, we are catching up with former United stopper Kevin Pilkington. He was, of course, the goalkeeper in that coveted class of 92. Played in the FA Youth Cup final, had many wonderful memories for Manchester United. Made 8 appearances in total, having come through the youth ranks. Behind Gary Walsh for the most appearances, coming through United's youth to play for the senior side. However, his first full start was certainly not one to remember. He'd previously come on as a substitute in a game against Crystal Palace in the Premier League. Didn't have too much time to prep for that one. His next game, however, first full competitive start for Manchester United, came in what was then the League Cup, of course, always been the League Cup. I think it was the Coca-Cola Cup at the time in the mid-90s. United hosted York City. Then games were two legs, of course. Hosted Minnows York City at Old Trafford. You'd think it would be a nice, easy game for him to come into. It turned out not to be the case.
I made my actual debut a couple of weeks before that against Palace. I came on after 7 minutes for Peter. He'd done his back in the warm-up. Yeah, I came on in that game and we beat Palace 3-0 and I did okay. The York game came about, and with the Palace game, it was like, right, you're on. So you didn't really have time to think about it. And then the York game, it was the day before, it was like, right, this is the team you're playing. And then you sat at home, you've got a full 24 hours to think about, right, I'm playing at Old Trafford, starting for the first team. You're thinking everything's good, and then the game kicks off, and the first goal, it's a strike from about 24, 25 yards, and it's got a little nick off Gary Pallister's heel, which took it away from me a little bit. It looked like I should save it, but I would say that the nick made it worse for me than what it was. And then Pat McGibbon, who was my roommate at the time, he got sent off, and then I come flapping for a cross. I think the third one was a penalty that I think he scored again. So yeah, after that you do get the treatment off the gaffer at the end of the game, the hairdryer treatment, and deservedly so, because it was an embarrassing result for us.
Did you get that personally from him?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because his standards were so high, and I should do better. Maybe not the first one, which was blamed at me, but definitely for the second one where I come to the cross. And this is what I keep saying to Dimi at the moment at Cambridge. I was chasing the game a little bit, trying to impress rather than just do my job. Yeah, I went chasing and come flying out for a cross, which I got nowhere near, and he beat me to it and had just headed into an empty goal. Yeah, it's one that makes you grow up quite quickly, to be honest.
Yeah, well, you touched on, you know, the fact that, of course, playing in a game like that and you're going to be nervous. It's a massive occasion. And back then, I'm guessing it was probably slightly different to now, whereas you mentioned the work you do with Dimi now. And I'm guessing you're there to have those discussions with him. And when he's going through the highs, the lows, you're able to help guide him as a coach. Did you have somebody like that back then when you're going into a game of this magnitude?
No, not really. At the time, we had Alan Hodgkinson in one day a week on a Monday morning. And that was the only day of the week that we got to do Pacific goalkeeper training. Like nowadays, there's the video analysis and watching people on how they play, how they deliver balls into the box, penalties, which way they go. We didn't have any of that. It was just like, right, off you go and play a game. And you didn't have anyone really to go and talk to. Even like, obviously, the goalkeepers. I mean, Pete was, he was just, right, it's just solely focused on his game, which is understandable. So it was difficult, but that was what it was. You didn't know anything else really back then. For me, that's the biggest part of me going into coaching is sharing my experiences when I was younger and trying to help them in their development.
A lot has been said about the hairdryer, which you mentioned there. So many different stories from so many players. As a young player that you were then, do you remember what he said to you and the impact that it had on you? I mean, going back into that changing room, were you petrified of what he was going to say?
You knew it was coming. You definitely knew it was coming. But I can't exactly remember what he said. I can remember we played Coventry away, and I played in the game, I think. I don't even remember it. It was a 3-2 game where Huckabee scored a couple of goals.
Mm. Yeah. Solo goal, one of them, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. Dion Dublin scored a penalty in that game, and I dived the wrong way for the penalty. And afterwards, he came into the changing room and he had to hurt me for not going the way that the penalty went. he did. He said, you should know, because obviously Dion was at Man United. You should know which way it was. It's wet. You should know he's going to go that way. And that is what he said to me. He said, because it's wet, you should know he was going to go the other way. And I was like, all right, okay. I didn't say anything back because I didn't say anything back. I just remember afterwards going, just sat there shaking my head, going, what the hell? Getting battered for not going the right way on the penalty. So, and again, no one really came up to me afterwards and just said anything to me, saying, oh, it's all right, don't worry about it. That's just a gaffer. No one said anything like that. But so, yeah, it's just them experiences that you learn from.
It's funny.
The right way for a penalty.
Was any part of you tempted to say something? Tempted to say that's absolute nonsense?
No. I then I've been about 21, 22 at the time. Yeah, okay, Gaffer, you're right. You're definitely right. I should have gone the right way.
There's one last game I wanted to talk to you about with regards to United. It was New Year's Day. It was 1996 against Spurs. United lost 4-1 that year. It was the year they eventually won the double when Cantona came back. But you played in that game. Again, you came off the bench for Schmeichel, who was injured in the warm-up, I think. What's interesting about that game was it was the second and last game of William Prunier. The myth of William Prunier. What was the deal there? That was a bizarre situation.
It was a bizarre situation. I don't know. This French fella just turned up. I don't know where he came from. He just turned up, and like I say, one of them was unfortunately that game that I played in. William Prunier. That was a... I don't know where, like I say, I've not got a clue where he came from. And I can just remember playing with him in that game. Yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
Was there a discussion among players? Were any of the team like, who is this guy? And he's definitely not good enough to play for Man United.
No, not that I can remember. I think there was afterwards.
Yeah.
No, not at the time. Like I say, it's the gaffer's judgment. But yeah, he didn't get much wrong though, did he? But maybe that one. No. And Taibbi.
Indeed, Massimo Taibbi. Perhaps he got that one wrong as well. That was Kevin Pilkington there. Really, really good chat with him on the Goalkeepers Union podcast with myself and Richard Lee. Top bloke, 8 games for Man United and many, many tales to tell. Right, this has been the Man United Fan Show. We will see you after the Sheffield United game next Sunday.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.